in the growth-led approach, which is related to what many economists think, the idea is that if you grow incomes, you'll fix a lot of problems in poor places. That does seem mostly right, but it doesn't mean that you can't address those problems without growing incomes. We want to think a lot about what are the other reasons why mortality persists from one generation to the next beyond the standard socioeconomic variables.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The risk that a child will die is lower than it used to be, but in low-income countries, it's still not unusual. But how persistent is this in families? And what does this tell us about the causes and consequences of child mortality? Well, Tom Vogel of University of California, San Diego, is one of the authors of a study of the persistence of child mortality. He's using data from a broad sample of developing countries. He joins me now. Tom, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim.
Economists commonly study intergenerational income or wealth persistence. Why might it be important to study child mortality persistence?
Right. So I guess I'm of two minds on this. One is sticking to the tendency of economists to focus on income and wealth, but confronted by the challenge that we're not very good at measuring income and wealth across generations in low and middle income countries. And so if we want to learn something about the persistence of life outcomes or the persistence of status within these places, we have to get a little more creative than we are able to do in Scandinavian countries with excellent registry data going back generations. Right. So one way that folks have been studying this is to focus on educational attainment, which is at least fixed over the life cycle. So it's a little easier to study because you can ask people at any point after they finish childhood and you'll still learn a pretty good picture of how much education they have. And you can ask them about their parents as well. But for the variables that economists care about most, like income and wealth, it's much harder to do. And we actually have a way to measure mortality across generations in a great many countries. So that's sort of a practical reason to study it from the perspective of economists who are, for some reason, especially focused on income and wealth variables that measure money in some way. The second reason, which is perhaps more compelling, is that mortality is a very, very relevant for human welfare.
Yeah.
It's a very, very deep cause of human well-being, both for the person who's dying, of course, but also for that person's relatives, parents, and so on.
Yes.
I think it's a particularly powerful way to think about how well-being or the determinants of well-being are passed from one generation to the next.
Now, I talked about the risk that a child will die being lower than it used to be, but how common is this in low-income countries? How common is this compared to historical rates of child mortality?
So the picture today is much better than it has ever been before.
Good.
So globally, that includes all countries, about 1 in 25 children die before age 5. And a few hundred years ago, it was more like one half.
Oh.
So there's been this massive decline in child mortality rates. In regions that we currently consider to be in the developing world, the rates are still somewhat higher, but they're a lot lower than they used to be even, say, you know, half a century ago. So in the mid-20th century, child mortality rates were about a third, 1 in 3 children died before age 5 in Africa. And now that number is more like 1 in 10. In Asia, it went from a quarter to about 1 in 20. In Latin America, from 1 in 5 to about 1 in 50. So rates are still high, and we would like to shrink them, especially relative to rich countries where the rates are much, much lower still. But there's been quite a bit of progress.
It is still, though, an extraordinary loss of life. What's causing it? What are the causes of child mortality now? How does that compare to what those causes were 100 years ago, I guess?
That's a great question. My read of the data is that the causes are still, in terms of their proportional contribution, they're still relatively similar to what they were in the past, at least in terms of broad categories. So, you know, about half of child mortality is due to infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
Big ones in that category are pneumonia, diarrheal disease, and malaria. About a quarter are due to preterm birth or neonatal conditions. Then there's some malnutrition and then some remaining causes. And that has roughly been consistent as we go back in time. As we go back in time, by the way, measurement gets pretty dicey because we have by now a pretty good handle on measuring how many people are dying, but measuring what they're dying of is a much more challenging thing
yeah.
in countries that don't have very robust vital reporting systems. But if you were to go back to, say, 1990, you would find a similar composition of the causes of child mortality, just those causes would be more prevalent.
So in this work that you're doing, measuring the persistence of child mortality, is it right for us to think about this in its context as a sort of a proxy for the persistence of income, wealth, or is it more nuanced? Is it more complicated than that?
That's a very interesting question. So going into the project, I fully expected it to mainly proxy for socioeconomic immobility, yeah, as you suggested. But what Francis and I found in this research is that the socioeconomic variables that we're able to measure don't explain much of the pattern. Mm-hmm. So it seems that there's more going on. And so ex post, after having the results, my way of thinking about this is that we know that equally poor places may have very different levels of health. And so determinants of ill health include income and other socioeconomic variables, but they go beyond those variables as well. And mortality persistence seems to in large part reflect those residual determinants. So public health programs, for example. So I guess it reminds me of this old debate regarding growth-led approaches and support-led approaches to improving the lives of the poor. So in the growth-led approach, which is related to what many economists think, the idea is that if you grow incomes, you'll fix a lot of problems in poor places. That does seem mostly right, but it doesn't mean that you can't address those problems without growing incomes. And so the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen likes to talk about places like Kerala, the state of Kerala in India, which since the mid-20th century has taken health and education policy very, very seriously and has improved outcomes in those areas over the rest of India by leaps and bounds, even though it didn't have particularly strong income growth. And so I think, you know, moving forward in our conversation, we want to think a lot about what are the other reasons why mortality persists from one generation to the next, beyond the standard socioeconomic variables.
Well, there are a lot of things to think about here, so let's have a look at how you did the research in a moment. Okay, so Tom, when you're setting out on a project like this, the very first thing you need is to be able to match mothers with grandmothers and find the appropriate data on child mortality for both. Where do you get that information?
The information comes from the Demographic and Health Surveys, which, as many of your listeners will know, are a collection of household surveys in many, many low and middle income countries, so about 90 countries. All of those surveys ask women aged 15 to 49 about the births and deaths of their kids, and some of them also ask them about the births and deaths of their siblings. That sibling module was added to the DHS to learn about mortality in adulthood. So from AIDS, for example, or from maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways I've been able to leverage those data in my research, both here and in some past work, is to notice that they also give us a window on the respondents' family situation when they were kids.
So collecting this data together, how many countries were you able to get the appropriate data for? How big is your data set?
We found 119 surveys with a sibling history module. So, you know, all of the surveys have the module on the respondents' childbearing history, but the ones with the sibling history number at 119, and that led to a sample of 44 countries. Those countries are scattered around the developing world, but especially concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, where the demographic and health surveys have focused the sibling history modules to learn about adult mortality. So I'll spare you some of the boring data cleaning issues, but we were left with about 1.3 million women and 2.5 million births.
That is a big data set, isn't it? So headline result, for a given age in a particular country, how high is this persistence in child mortality?
So there are a number of ways to summarize it,
yeah,
but I at least find that persistence in experiencing at least one child death is the most intuitive way and the most striking way. So let me give you that first, and then we can talk about some other quantification methods as well. Mm-hmm. So we find that within a country at a given age, women who had at least one sibling die under five face about 40% higher odds of losing a child compared to women who didn't have deceased siblings.
Gosh, that is high.
That translates to about a 7 percentage point difference by the late 40s. So the first statement I made was proportional, and the second statement I made was in terms of absolute mortality risk, and maybe people will find the second statement the most intuitive. So a 7 percentage point gap, which essentially means that the probability of losing at least one childhood by, say, age 50 rises from about 40% to 47%.
And looking at it from the other end, if I am a child, how much more likely is it that I will die if I know that one of my mother's siblings died young?
I love that you're asking the questions in this order, because it's exactly how I would have thought of it as well. So indeed, the numbers change when you look at it from a child's perspective rather than a woman's perspective.
Yeah.
And so a child whose mom lost at least one sibling under five is about 2 percentage points more likely to die before their own fifth birthday. Mm-hmm. If you break it up by the number of the mom's sibling's deaths, you find that each additional sibling death is associated with a 1 percentage point rise in the child's risk. So that's on a base of about 10% risk for the child.
So using this data, is it possible, as you say, it's difficult to think about causes for this in detail. How much of this can you find using this data?
If your question about causes is specifically about the proximate health conditions that cause this persistence, we don't have much to work with in this data set. But we can say something about the somewhat deeper causes. So in terms of thinking about what sorts of determinants of ill health are persisting from one generation to the next. And so some of those potential channels, it might be socioeconomic immobility, as we've discussed already. Mm-hmm. It might be the inheritance of place, that women tend to live in the places where they were born, and there are healthier places to be born and less healthy places to be born. It might be inherited health, so the idea that moms who have deceased siblings were less healthy themselves in childhood, and they pass some of that poor health onto their own kids. So those three we'll be able to shed some light on. There are others as well. You could think about cultural persistence, so in healthcare practices that are passed along from one generation to the next. As we all know, you know, grandma tells mom what to do to keep the kids safe and healthy. And then there are some very interesting issues relating to genetics, which we are just not able to measure at all in these survey data.
Of course, but for what you are able to measure, it strikes me it must be extremely difficult to disentangle the influence of these potential channels. How do you do that econometrically?
Yeah, so this is going to be a bit more speculative because these questions are ultimately causal and we don't have research designs to disentangle these causal channels.
Mm-hmm.
But we can add, you know, some measures of these channels to our econometric model to see if we can explain away mortality persistence. And so, you know, on the first that I discussed on socioeconomic immobility, we can proxy for that concept by including the measure of assets that the household owns, by including maternal education in the model. And we find, somewhat surprisingly to me, that those factors only account for about 10 to 20% of mortality persistence.
Surprising, yes.
Even comparing households that have the same number of assets, comparing women who have the same number of years of education, we still find 80 to 90% of the mortality persistence that we found before. The persistence of place channel that I mentioned accounts for much, much more. So we find that it accounts for about half of mortality persistence, which is to say that the child mortality differential between women with and without deceased siblings shrinks by about half when you move from comparing women in the same country to comparing women in the same village. And so that seems like an important result, which you and I can grapple with more in the coming minutes. But before we get to that, let me just mention the one other channel that we have some evidence on, although this is our weakest evidence, I think, mm-hmm. which is on the inheritance of health channel, right? The idea that less healthy moms who had less healthy childhoods pass on some of that ill health to their kids when they grow up. So our only measure of their respondent's childhood health is her height, mm-hmm. Which is a proxy for physical growth in childhood. So moms who were less healthy when they were kids will attain less physical height given their genetic growth potential. And, you know, we do indeed find that the mom's height is correlated with children's mortality, but it doesn't explain any of mortality persistence. So to the extent that we can measure, we don't find that the persistence of health per se is, or the inheritance of health per se is the main operating factor here.
As you say, it's surprising what you don't find evidence for here, but also what you do find evidence for, this huge result on place. But what does place mean when we're talking about it here? Is it where you start out, where you end up? Is it prompting for something else?
Right, exactly. So these are great questions. And I guess there are two ways to think about your question of what place means. One is empirical, which it sounds like is the main thing you have in mind from what you've said so far. The other is conceptual. So let me start with the empirical issue, which you're exactly right, is to wonder whether this is about the place you're born or the place where you end up, right? Because people move around. Unfortunately, we don't do it terribly good job of measuring people moving around in surveys like the demographic and health surveys.
Yeah.
And that actually brings up an ambiguity in our results. So one way that place may be important is that women inherit unhealthy places. And that's indeed the way I've been framing this finding, right? Women inherit unhealthy places from their moms, The other way that place might be relevant is that particularly disadvantaged women move to unhealthy places or are less likely to move away from them. And so economists would call that second class of explanations a selection mechanism that has to do with what sorts of women wind up in these places that are more unhealthy. So we don't, unfortunately, see exactly where a woman spent her childhood in our data. Mm-hmm. But some of the surveys ask women whether they've lived in the same place all their lives. And if we look just at those women who report having lived in the same place all their lives, place accounts for just as much of mortality persistence as it does in our full sample. Okay, and so that suggests that a big part of what's going on here is this inheritance of place story, where women who are born in places that have, say, a lot of infectious disease or that have poor public health infrastructure tend to stay there. And so their kids also experience those adverse conditions in childhood. So, you know, at the very end of that overview of the empirical interpretation of place, I started getting into concepts, right? So we could think of it indeed as reflecting health conditions or public health infrastructure. It might also reflect unmeasured wealth or unmeasured human capital, right? That goes beyond what we're actually able to measure in the survey, and we can't rule that out. We haven't made a ton of progress on disentangling those, but I think there's a lot of scope for doing it. And given some of our other results, I think the public health story, the idea that some places are very well served by public health programs and public health infrastructure, and some places aren't, I think that story holds a lot of water.
Tom, this is a very impressive piece of detective work. I want to talk to you a little bit about what this might mean in policy terms and how things are changing. So I guess the first question is, as infant mortality declines, which is the good news story, does the intergenerational persistence of infant mortality decline as well?
Right. So these are exactly the results that made me optimistic about the public health story that I described in my last answer. So we can ask what happens to mortality persistence as child mortality declines overall within the country. Right? And so it could go either way. You could imagine that families that initially have a lot of child deaths might see a lot of mortality decline, while those that didn't have much mortality before don't see much mortality decline. And in that case, we would say that mortality decline reduces mortality persistence.
Yeah.
But it could go the other way as well, right? The benefits of mortality decline could accrue to the already low mortality families, and those that have higher mortality might not see much benefit, in which case we would see these inequalities grow. And so we find evidence for the former story, that mortality persistence shrinks during the process of mortality decline, at least in absolute terms. And so that is to say that the benefits of mortality decline accrue disproportionately to these high mortality lineages, which I guess in somewhat fuzzier terms is another way of saying that the aggregate process of mortality decline is progressive, or at least it was progressive over the last 50 years or so in developing countries.
So looping this back to where we started, talking about the research that's been done on the intergenerational persistence of income or wealth, how do these results compare to those earlier results?
Yeah, so there's no exact analog, but it makes me think of two patterns that are discussed a lot in the literature on income and wealth inequality. So the first is a very classic result, which was originally a very clear result and has since become sort of a general hypothesis that people test, and there's evidence for and against it. That result, the original result, is called the Kuznets curve, and it dates back to Simon Kuznets, who was a famous economist in the last century. So the Kuznets curve proposes that inequality first rises and then falls with aggregate income growth. So the basic idea is that initial phases of development, some people get very well off while others don't grow with them. But eventually, the early developers within the society pull up the rest of society with them so that you get this widening inequality, and then inequality shrinks again. And so somewhat related to our finding that persistent mortality inequality falls with aggregate mortality decline. Right? So in the Kuznets version, you know, the aggregate process is income growth. In our version, the aggregate process is mortality decline, but both of them represent some form of progress, right? And so it's a question about how inequality changes with progress. And we find that this persistent inequality, as measured by mortality persistence, falls with aggregate progress. The second pattern that's commonly discussed, at least in the past decade or so, in the literature on intergenerational income mobility, is something that my late colleague Alan Krueger called the Great Gatsby curve.
Yes.
So Alan had this now well-known graph that showed that more unequal countries have less intergenerational income mobility. And so in a sense, because we're looking at how intergenerational persistence changes with aggregate progress, we're sort of combining the Kuznets curve with the Great Gatsby curve.
But of course, one thing you noted earlier in the conversation, and I guess it's a trap that I'm falling into here, is talking about child mortality as if it was income or wealth dollars. This is about people, isn't it? It's very important to consider people and to consider the fact that there are millions of bereaved mothers left behind. How should we consider them in this?
That's a very good question, and one where I think economists are somewhat behind some other fields in the social sciences in thinking about these issues. So on the one hand, there's growing evidence on the importance of bereavement for the well-being of family members, especially mothers. Some of that evidence actually comes from economics. There's a well-known recent paper that shows that moms pass on stress to their kids if they experience family bereavement while the kids are in utero. So that's rich country evidence, but there's good reason to believe that it would hold in other settings as well. Well, the area that economists are a bit behind other fields, in particular social demography, is in thinking about death from the perspective of social connections rather than just from the perspective of the person who died. Mm-hmm. So in demography, there's a big new literature that tries to quantify the burden of mortality from the perspective of friends and relatives of the deceased. And so it changes the perspective substantially and changes the quantitative extent of mortality, or the way we would perceive that extent, substantially as well. So I told you at the beginning of our conversation that child mortality rates in Africa are about 1 in 10, right? So about 1 in 10 children die before their 5th birthday.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in some African countries, about half of middle-aged women have experienced at least one child death. And so if we think about women and how much risk they have accumulated over their lifetimes, right? Having mm-hmm. had multiple children, those numbers can be much higher from the woman's perspective than from the child's perspective. And that's representing a lot of trauma that's out there.
Ultimately, what we want to do is to reduce this risk, reduce the trauma, reduce the amount of child mortality, and specifically to reduce its persistence as well. Is the policy solution to this to assume that if we generate more wealth, that development process will be the best way to tackle this problem? Or are there more specific policies that you think we should be thinking of?
I think that there's good evidence to suggest that income growth would help on this front, yeah. But our results, particularly on the importance of place and on the evolution of these gaps as aggregate mortality decline happens, suggest that public health policy could also do a lot to reduce mortality persistence. But I guess my concluding note is that I think there's a lot more remaining work to pin that down.
Well, good luck with doing some of the remaining work, Tom. This strikes me as being extremely valuable. And as you say, raises some questions that maybe economics hasn't considered as much as other disciplines. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
Thanks, Tim.
The paper is called Intergenerational Persistence in Child Mortality, and the authors are Francis Liu and Tom Vogel. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And all our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.